Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, and welcome back to the Potential Psychology Podcast. This is episode number 37. Ellen here, workplace and coaching psychologist, podcaster, parent, partner, carer to one cat and four chickens, and as of last week, webinar host. I ran what I hope will be the first of many webinars for some fabulous members of the Potential Psychology community on productivity and well-being and where and why they intersect. And we covered six simple tips for upping your well-being and your productivity because the two actually go hand in hand in a rather bi-directional manner. So we know that better well-being actually equals a greater productivity and vice versa. And I'm going to share one of the tips and little bits of, I think, rather fascinating and helpful research that we covered in a moment. But I have an exciting announcement to make first. It's about an upcoming episode of the podcast. In fact, our final episode for this season, number 40, and I really need your help with it. March 20 is not only the final episode for the season when it will be published, but March 20 is also International Happiness Day, which is kind of fortuitous. And the following day, March 21st, is the Potential Psychology Podcast's first birthday. We will be 12 months old on March the 21st. And to celebrate this happy coincidence of these three events, I have something special planned. My plan is to compile some of the best happiness tips that our experts have shared with us on the podcast over our first 12 months. But I also want to hear from you. What makes you happy? When are you at your happiest? And what have you discovered about happiness that you perhaps didn't know a year ago? So this is your chance to share your little bit of happiness with other members of our audience. Process itself, it'll be pretty simple. You don't need to be live on the podcast or anything like that. You can just leave me an audio message. And with my producer Andy's help, we'll gather these messages together and include as many of them as we can into the episode itself. So it's an opportunity to share our collective happiness with each other to celebrate International Happiness Day and the podcast's first birthday. How cool is that? I'll give you details about how to do this in next week's episode, but I'm also going to let all of my subscribers know. So if you receive the Potential Psychology newsletter every 2 weeks, I'll pop the link in there. So we actually record it, or you'll be able to record your message via just a special voicemail web page, just using your PC or even your phone. It'll be super simple. And I'll share the link in my next newsletter, which will hit inboxes on Friday the 1st of March, and then again in the newsletter that goes out on Friday the 15th of March. And I'll also share the link and tell you how to send me your message, your happiness message, via plenty of posts on all my social feeds. So keep an eye out for those, Facebook and Instagram, etc. Okay, I'm going to give you a quick productivity tip, and then we're going to explore the well-being of veterinarians with today's guest. And my question for you is, do you ever procrastinate? Yes, I think I hear you saying yes. I figure that we all do this at least on occasion. And if you're anything like me, you probably beat yourself up for procrastinating as well. You might get cranky and annoyed with yourself. I know I do. And here's an interesting idea from some research that's been done into procrastination from Bishop's University in Canada. And that is, when you are procrastinating, or you find yourself procrastinating, try not to get cranky and upset with yourself and frustrated and beat yourself up. Try a little self-compassion instead. Forgive yourself for procrastinating. Accept that you're human. We're all human. We're not machines. And sometimes we procrastinate or feel lazy or get distracted, and that's okay. That's just being human. Because it seems that when we beat ourselves up for procrastinating, we actually get stuck in a cycle of negative feelings and negative emotions that makes us, instead of less likely to procrastinate, in fact, more likely to do so. So self-compassion kind of frees us up from that negative emotion. It makes us feel less bad about it. And quite possibly, it looks like from the research, it increases the likelihood that we'll actually get on with the tasks that we've been avoiding. So self-compassion to avoid procrastination. And I reckon that's worth a try. Okay, so while we're talking about having high expectations of ourselves, it's time to introduce today's guest and our conversation, which is about veterinarians. Because as we'll find out, the two are related, particularly when it comes to stress and well-being. Today, I'm kicking off the first of a few conversations specific to well-being within particular professions. And my guest has spent 10 years researching why the mental health of veterinarians has become so compromised and what can be done about it. Dr. Nadine Hamilton is a psychologist who's worked with vets in her private practice to help them develop better coping strategies and get on top of stress and psychological fatigue to avoid burnout and prevent suicide. She also works with veterinary practice managers and owners to increase well-being, productivity, and the retention of vets in the workplace. And she's the author of a new book, Coping with Stress and Burnout as a Veterinarian. Welcome, Nadine.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, this is a topic of particular interest to me, as I've done some work with local vets and vet practices in our area. And I also have a niece who's studying vet science. Hello to Bridie, if you're listening.
Hi, Bridie.
So I'm interested to know, first up, why are vets stressed?
So originally the research when I started mine was suggestive of having to perform euthanasia, and it was all around, you know, that was the most stressful factor involved. So my research actually started as the phenomenology of euthanasia. Why is it so tough? Why is it having these effects? But as I sort of launched into my research and I interviewed vets one-on-one, I sort of said, look, these are the contributing factors. You know, euthanasia was up there as number one. Do you agree? Do you disagree? Anything to add? And basically what came back from that was, yes, certainly euthanasia can be hard. Not all the vets struggled with it, but the majority of them did that were in my research. But they also said the financial concerns. So having to have those discussions with clients about how much the treatment's going to cost, or if the client couldn't afford the treatment, but the treatment could save the pet's life, and then that resulting in euthanasia because, you know, it was the client's decision. So that was putting a lot of stress on, as well as the vets who own their own practice and the financial stress of running a practice, you know, because it's typically very low profit margins. So that all contributed to it. The compassion fatigue. So, you know, it's common obviously in the helping professions, but especially in the veterinary profession, because they're being compassionate to the animal as well, who is like their patient, but also trying to be compassionate to the owners who are, you know, like their clients. So it's like a double whammy, and having to, you know, continually show that empathy and compassion and caring. Also the unrealistic expectations. So the unrealistic expectations that the customers put on them. So expecting an instant diagnosis and a complete cure, or, you know, the clients who said, well, you removed this growth from my animal 5 years ago. Why has it now come back? Just those expectations, but also the expectations that the veterinary professionals are putting on themselves. So, you know, I should, I must, I have to. You know, they're typically very high performers, and, you know, a lot of vets have said to me, we're not set up for failure. It's drummed in, you know, we're the best of the best. We have to always be high performing to be able to, like, get through uni and then to be able to make it as a good vet, you know, out there in the real world. So again, all of these expectations just add up. So they just all just accumulate with everything. Typically the unrealistic expectations, dealing with difficult clients, the financial concerns, compassion fatigue, and performing euthanasia. And the dealing with difficult clients, I think from my own research, I would say the financial issues and dealing with difficult clients, they're probably the two biggest factors, you know, just from snide remarks that are made, offhand comments, or just people being rude, not understanding how their behaviour is having an impact on the staff. You know, for them, they may feel that they're the only person in that vet's day without thinking, what has this vet just come out of? What are they about to go into? You know, so it's a lot of that contributes to it as well.
And do vets get trained in business and finance?
Not that I know of. From my understanding there, I know from discussions with Emeritus Professor Trevor Heath, who was the head of the vet school at UQ up here in Queensland for many years before he retired. And, you know, he spoke to me about communication was never something that was part of the curriculum. And he was instrumental in having that brought into the curriculum, but it had to be worded very carefully because it was like, oh, we didn't sort of mention these kind of words or, you know, problem solving or conflict. So it had to be brought in very nicely. So I think there is some coverage of communication, but I don't know how extensive that is. And obviously each of the universities have probably got their different level of how they actually do that and how much detail, but it's such a big part of it, you know, because some of the vets as well are saying, you know, a lot of them get into veterinary medicine because they love animals, not expecting that they're going to have to deal with the human counterparts as well. So they're not prepared for that. And so I think that sort of throws a big curveball there for some of them, like, well, how do I deal with these rude, obnoxious people and amongst everything else, you know, the stress of the day and everything else that's going on.
Yeah, because it's like being a parent often, isn't it? Being a pet owner, you know, you are just as you're certainly emotionally invested
in
the health and well-being of this family member. So emotions could run high, tempers could run high, people are stressed, and that's the kind of scenario. Well, we know as psychologists, you know, you could, there's a lot of skill and learning involved with people when they're in that kind of state. So that does make it complex. And then you've got that combination of those two factors of the financial element and the stressed individuals.
Exactly.
And perhaps lack of understanding on their part that, you know, what it is to run a business. All of these things tie in together.
Well, that's right. And I think, you know, a lot of the discussions that have come out, and we sort of covered it in our campaign videos around, there's no Medicare for our pets, you know, so we don't have pedicare. And, you know, even with pet insurance, you know, quite often we have to pay up front and then get a rebate, or we might only get a portion back depending on the policy. So I think because, you know, particularly here in Australia, we're so lucky that we've got Medicare here. So we don't really see the costs of our own medical care, you know, and how much every doctor's appointment or scan or x-ray, all of those things actually add up to be. But with our pets, we do notice it because we're having to pay every cent of that treatment. So in comparison, you know, and I've done comparisons with my own medical care versus the veterinary care that I've had my pets at, and the medical care has outweighed the vet care, I would say, in every case that I've had. But because, you know, it's either bulk billed or you've got a rebate, you're not noticing the out-of-pocket expense. You know, and so part of that with, you know, that the difficult client aspect of it is that the vets are then abused. You're just in it for the money. How dare you charge this amount of money? All of those sorts of things where it's like, well, how much did your, you know, procedure at a public hospital actually cost? You know, I used to get it in private practice. Oh, I want my free sessions, my free psychology sessions. So, well, they're actually not free.
They're not free.
They may be bulk billed. Exactly. But, you know, Medicare's actually paying for this if it's bulk billed. And, you know, again, it's that perception, you know, that we're so privileged with our human care that we just expect that that should be the same thing for our pets. And unfortunately, it's not.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, what can a vet do in those sorts of scenarios? What's a good strategy for dealing with that particular issue of people not really having an appreciation of the costs involved to provide the care to the animals?
Yeah. I think, and this is a debate that comes up quite a lot. So some vets will just talk to the client and say, okay, well, you know, well, what is your budget? And this is what we can do for your budget. Like, you know, if we had all the money in the world, this is what we would like to do for the best possible outcome. But if that's not a reality, then this is what your options are. And then letting the customer decide. A lot of the time the customer will want the vets to make a decision, which can then be stressful. But, you know, I think it's empowering the vets to be assertive enough to say, well, this is what it costs. You know, if we go for treatment somewhere else, you know, for our own human care, or we're taking our car to the mechanic or whatever, we're just told, well, this is how much it's going to cost to service your car, or this is how much this appointment's going to cost, and we either accept it or we don't. Mm. It's like, this is the way it is, but the vets don't seem to have that same luxury. And again, it's the emotional blackmail that, well, you love animals, you should be doing this for nothing, you should be a community service, all of that, you know, and they're highly, highly qualified people, professionals as well. So, you know, it's sad to see that they don't have a lot of that respect
In
that regard.
Yes, because I think probably you wouldn't necessarily treat a surgeon in a hospital who's, you know, assisting a family member in that way. I mean, maybe to some extent, you know, tempers are still high and emotions still run high.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine somebody having that kind of conversation about the cost involved.
Yes, exactly.
Because as you say, they don't see the cost.
They don't see the cost. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yep. And it's very unfair, you know, and there's also debate about, you know, well, if you can't afford a pet, you shouldn't have one. I mean, and that raises a lot of emotions as well. And I'm not sort of buying into the argument either way. I think it's being prepared that, you know, yes, you may have a healthy animal, but you also need to be prepared that something could happen outside of the blue that you're not expecting, you know. And I've been in that situation before, you know, where you are faced with something, you go, wow, I didn't see this coming. We've had pet insurance, we've elected to do that just to give us that peace of mind, you know, but there's also times when we haven't had pet insurance as well, and it's like, okay, we understand that if any of our animals need treatment, then we'll do whatever it takes, you know, which is our commitment, and knowing that, you know, that's our choice to be able to do that. So I think it's having an understanding that pets cost money. You know, you might be very blessed and have one that, you know, you just, your annual treatments and your food and those sorts of things, but you just never know what could come up and what illness or what trauma they might experience and how much that realistically is going to cost.
Yeah, I have a diabetic cat.
Wow.
And I mean, it's ongoing treatment at this point in time. It's blood tests and it's insulin and it's, a lot of assessment and special food and all of those sorts of things. But you're right, you know, you do. And every once in a while I'm like, oh my goodness, this is so expensive. But I have to have that conversation with myself, you know, this a path that I've chosen to go down. I mean, I personally would pay whatever.
Yes. You'd sell your soul for it.
But you know, again, not everybody has the luxury of being able to do that, I suppose. Yes. And I could well understand how that would result in some really tricky conversations.
Definitely. And ultimately, it's not the vet's fault, you know, if this animal is, you know, if it develops, you know, an illness or anything like that, that's through no fault of the vet, obviously, you know, like it's not been misdiagnosed or anything like that, just general things happening. One of the vets I was following the other day, you know, did a discussion about that, and she said the other thing too with the pharmaceuticals is there's no PBS. So there's no support or subsidy for vet medication. So, of course, that seems expensive as well because you're paying 100% of the cost. It's not subsidised by the government like a lot of our human medication is, you know.
Yes, and these are priced for what is exactly the same insulin.
Exactly. Just go to your doctor, you know, say, oh, okay, how much would this actually cost, and do that comparison. But again, because, it's an animal-prescribed medication and there's no subility for that, then we do notice the full cost of that.
So it strikes me that one of the, I suppose, strategies or ways to alleviate these sorts of stressors might be around some kind of education for the clients in this regard, you know, whether, as you say, so those conversations up front, or even just, you know, maybe as a profession, there's an opportunity for vets to publicize the fact that there's all of this stuff that people don't necessarily think about, you know, that might help to resolve some of that, or at least, you know, give people a different perspective before they lay into somebody.
Yes, absolutely.
About the cost of their vet treatment.
Absolutely. And that's where we've developed the Love Your Pet, Love Your Vet campaign, which is sort of three-pronged. You know, it is around, targeted towards veterinary professionals, and not just vets, but also the nurses, the technicians, the students, because they are obviously just as at risk, and reducing the stigma. So we're trying to encourage them to speak out and empower themselves to be assertive and have these conversations and not be afraid of, you know, what will everyone else think and, you know, all those thoughts that a lot of us have in those situations. So we want to really reduce the stigma, but we also want to educate the community into the realities of what's going on. You know, a lot of the perceptions are that the vet's just playing with puppies and kittens all day. You know, they drive their fancy cars, they live in their mansions, they're out on their boats all day, living the good life, you know, and the reality is far from that for the majority of them. Absolutely. We want to really raise that awareness, but we were trying to educate the community to say, this is what's going on, but this is actually what you can do to help. So, you know, like, refrain on those snide remarks, because you might think that it's said sarcastically and just as a bit of a joke, but that vet could have heard that same comment, you know, 20 times that day, and it starts to wear a little bit thin after a while, you know, when, again, the majority of them want the best for the pet, you know, and they're trying to do the best they can. And again, you know, a lot of the things when we're talking about costs before, you know, it costs money to have the best equipment there, you know, the ultrasounds, the CTs, the MRIs, having all of that equipment there costs money. And to make, I guess, the advances in the veterinary care, we need a lot of this equipment so that we can make the decisions and the diagnoses and those sorts of things. Whereas, you know, back in the day, it may not have seemed as expensive to go to the vet, but we didn't have all these facilities that we do now, you know, and all of these things cost money and they're beyond the vet's control. They don't price the equipment or the pharmaceuticals or anything like that, but they're sort of the end user, and so they tend to cop the the abuse that goes with it, you know, when that happens.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that, you know, as a client, as the end user or the pet owner, you know, you really want your vet to have all of that.
Absolutely. Same as us in the human world, isn't it? You know, when you've got to go and have tests done, you want to make sure that you're getting the best outcome you can. And, you know, as we said before, we're just very fortunate if, you know, we're going through the Medicare system, or, you know, we've got the luxury of private health where it's not really costing us that out-of-pocket expense, but we don't have that luxury for the pets in a lot of the cases.
Mm. We've talked about the veterinary professionals themselves or the veterinarians, but do these sorts of issues affect other staff within a practice? Because it's not just the vets, is it?
Absolutely.
Staff and admin staff.
Absolutely. I think all veterinary professionals are at risk. Certainly there have been suicides, you know, with other professionals, not just the vets. Mm. There's unfortunately not a lot of research into the other professions. So I've just started a PhD, so I'm doing a second doctorate now, just to take this even further.
Just for something else to do.
Just for something else, you know, because I've not got enough on my plate as it is. But, you know, obviously my last doctorate was purely around vets, because that's where the research are and we wanted to really specialise on that. And then being able to go, you know, this just doesn't affect the vets alone. You know, it does extend. You know, the nurses are on the front line a lot of the time, so they'll cop a lot of that. I mean, there are things that a nurse would experience that the vet may not, and vice versa, so that, you know, they have their own unique issues, but a lot of the things are the same. But I think I found one or two articles around vet nurse suicide. That's it. That's all I've been able to find. So I want to start researching that, you know, and sort of looking into it, because certainly I've heard a lot of stories about those professionals who have taken their own lives, you know, but it's just not documented. And also how it's reported, not all of the states will document it as a suicide, or they don't document their profession, or it might be ruled accidental where it was a suicide, or vice versa. So it's a bit restricted. So it could actually be higher than what we know as well. But yeah, certainly it extends to, you know, pretty much all of them that are working in there, because they're all exposed to the same stressors, plus their own little unique things that come in as well.
And the suicide rates amongst the vets, those that we do have some data on, are extraordinary, aren't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. So the research has shown around four times the national average. So they're four times more likely than the general population and twice as likely as any other health professional. And the reason I was quite amazed when I very first found out about this, because I thought dentists had the highest suicide rate, which as someone explained to me, I think vets are categorised with a profession that is very low in suicide. So the results are actually quite skewed. So they are obviously right up there. Or in Australia, it's roughly one vet every 12 weeks that will suicide, you know, which is just... So the rate itself, like the actual number of people, is quite low. But the percentage, when you compare that to the averages, is very high. And
it's really high.
Yeah, yeah, it's fairly consistent, 3 to 4 times the national average, sort of when we're looking at UK, US, Canada, as well as Australia. So,
So these factors global that you mentioned are really having an impact.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And of course, we talk about, I mean, this suicide is measurable, although not purely measurable, but it's a measurable thing. And what we can't measure necessarily is the level of stress and mental health issues that are leading up, you know, that it's really just the iceberg, isn't it? There's all of that.
Absolutely.
That must be going on, yep, beneath.
Absolutely.
That result. Yep.
And that's sort of the analogy I use, the tip of the iceberg, because I think, you know, it's, as you would know in psychology, the presenting issue usually isn't the problem. So, you know, if someone's talking about all this stuff going on the tip, it's like that's not usually the real reason. It's all this other underlying stuff. I know, again, from discussions that I've had in the industry when we're talking about, well, why aren't the vets in particular reaching out and support? Some of the feedback I've had from that, obviously the stigma in doing so. Some have said like the pride or the ego, and not saying that they're big egos, but, you know, the pride side of the ego as well.
Yeah.
There's other feedback too saying that they don't want to have that on record, that they're struggling psychologically in case it gets back to the registration board and then affects their ability to practice. So a lot of it's going undisclosed.
Okay.
You know, and we don't really know in research that I've done or been able to find what the rate of pre-existing psychological issues are before getting into vet school. So
that would be an interesting question, wouldn't it?
Sort of like chicken or the egg. It's like, is vet school exacerbating something pre-existing? I know from a lot of the clients that I've worked with, there's been pre-existing issues. So my hypothesis is that there's definitely pre-existing psychological issues a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. But it's, again, is that exacerbated by the nature of the job, or is the nature of the job contributing to that? You know, it's sort of, again, chicken.
Yeah.
Which one's contributing to which? So,
because one of the things that struck me having observed students entering the profession is, and this goes to your point about the expectations, not necessarily of clients, we've discussed that, but self-expectation, is that getting into vet science, can you talk us through what the requirements are? Because it's not as easy as just finishing school and applying.
And that was what Trevor Heath talks about. He writes about in the foreword of the book, which I was quite interested in. You know, I think many years ago it was open entry because it wasn't as popular, but then it started becoming more and more popular, so then they had to have the prerequisites on there. I believe a lot of the schools now are doing away with OP scores, but traditionally it was like an OP of 1. I think from latest discussions that I had with one of the universities, I think it's now like an OP of 2 or 3. I think the requirement has dropped.
And the OP is that's a Queensland.
Okay. Term. Is it a Queensland thing? Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't know, but it would be the equivalent. I'm in Victoria, so we have the ATAR score. So, yeah.
Okay. It's the highest you can get.
It's a big score or a small score, depending on how the scale works.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, absolutely. So it's pretty much the best of the best.
Yep.
You know, to be able to get in. And then, of course, you've got to be able to sustain that level of study and be passing all of your exams, you know, like most of us that have gone to uni. But again, there's those expectations that we're not allowed to fail. You know, we have to always be, you know, perfect per se.
Yep.
And because we have all of these high expectations on us that we have to be the best to get in, and then we have to be able to maintain that.
Yeah.
And there's no room for failure or anything. You know, again, those are a lot of those expectations, which are quite unrealistic to think, you know, you're expected, or they're expecting themselves to be a high achiever and get high distinctions on every single exam. I mean, yeah, it'd be wonderful, but, you know, they still say P's get degrees. So we'd all like to be high distinction students, but the reality is, if we can pass those exams, then that's still a massive accomplishment.
And that's all that's fundamentally required.
Exactly.
But it's a lot of hoops to jump through. And that's what, you know, we know as psychologists that those self-expectations, those high expectations of, you know, almost perfection in everything we do.
Absolutely.
And they're often associated with anxiety and stress.
Yes.
And because the world doesn't allow perfect, it doesn't help set things up.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, yeah, I can see that, you know, that just that combination of having to do really well at school, then maintain that with, you know, really high, consistent study and marks at university. And then, of course, there's the competition for jobs. And then, of course, you're working with a whole lot of other people who are exactly the same.
Exactly. And then that then triggers the imposter syndrome, which I just did a webinar on that recently, which was just massive because it's something that I'm seeing that, you know, feeling like a phony, which is quite common, you know, and a lot of people when they graduate. And, you know, I think we've all been there. I know I have, you know, sort of going, what am I doing here? Do I really know what I'm doing?
Psychologists are a bit guilty of that too.
Yeah. We'd probably psychoanalyze ourselves more than everyone else. But that really comes in. And so they're afraid to speak up and ask questions because it's like, well, I have to have all the answers because I should be perfect. And I can't ask questions because that would be a sign of perceived weakness. You know, so all of these thoughts that are just irrational and unrealistic going through their mind, because what if I get found out by the phony police and they see that I really am an imposter and I don't know what I'm doing? You know, so that can contribute to a lot of like the conflict or the bullying in the workplace where, you know, someone wants to take the focus on them because they don't want to be found out for, you know, that they're not an imposter, but they feel like one. So they'll put the emphasis on somebody else, or they feel that they have to work longer and harder to show that they're perfect and to not make any mistakes, you know, which again just contributes to that stress and that anxiety. And then the depression can kick in, the burnout kicks in, and then like, well, where do I go from here?
It is complicated. And again, I'm guessing, because I know this just doesn't happen in really many professions at all that I'm aware of. You know, we learn these skills because we're psychologists and we're supposed to be helping other people with them. But, you know, it's some fundamental training in how our minds can make life more difficult for us and can cause us stress and anxiety probably wouldn't go astray.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's important, you know, for us all to have those coping strategies. You know, I think coping strategies should be taught when we're at school to be able to deal with, everyday things that are going through, but particularly in a profession that is at such high risk. You know, of suicide, it's, you know, in my opinion, it's like
it's almost a duty of care.
Yeah. And we need to do something more. Like, it doesn't have to be this way. It's preventable. But if we know that the profession is stressful, how do we equip the vets and the nurses, the techs, how do we equip them with the strategies to be able to cope with it? You know, which is sort of what my doctoral research looked at.
Yeah, and that leads us nicely into your book, which is called Coping with Stress and Burnout as a Veterinarian. And the subtitle is An Evidence-Based Solution to Increase Wellbeing. So in the book, you talk about the challenges that we've discussed that make vets more prone to stress and burnout and ultimately, sadly, suicide, you know, higher suicide rates as well. You do mention some of the strengths. And I think that's probably really important to bring out as well, because we talked about, you know, what some of the challenges are and some of the attributes of people who enter the profession and then the system that might kind of exacerbate some of those.
Yeah,
they have strengths that they bring to their profession as well, don't they?
Yeah. And I think you can look at strengths as in, you know, their strengths like their determination and the loyalty and the hard work and those aspects of strengths, but also the strengths from the positive psychology realm, like the character strengths. And it was essentially would have been a PhD in itself to actually analyze the character strengths. But it's one of the things that I did look at in my doctoral research to look at what character strengths were quite common, you know, and we couldn't obviously make any definitive guesses because we didn't analyze it in detail. But, you know, we're looking at the top strengths out of the 24 character strengths that have been identified. Kindness and fairness were two that repeatedly were in the top 10, and in the majority were in at least the top five. And, you know, so it's about they want that fairness and making sure that everything's fair and, you know, equal treatment for everybody, but also that kindness. And I think the kindness then, you know, lies in with the compassion, but sometimes that's taken advantage of, know, and used against them, you know, like with the emotional blackmail and those aspects. But I think, again, with a lot of the vets, you know, do have those high performer perfectionist tendencies. So I think they are always striving for the best possible outcome. They do want the best. You know, for the animal, and they're so determined to get to the bottom of what's going on. And, you know, I think those are real strengths. I would say things that maybe aren't such a strength would be like the assertiveness, you know, being able to communicate and have those conversations with their clients. Like, nobody likes the conflict, or very few people like the conflict, but it's important, you know, to be able to stand up, you know, and sort of say assertively to a client that, you know, I don't think that's very fair of you to make those comments, or, you know, it's actually not true. This is where the costs are, or, you know, those sorts of things. And again, the majority of, you know, the remarks are related to finances and those aspects, or, yeah, again, wanting the vets to make those decisions, which puts the pressure on the vets, because the owner doesn't want to make that decision and have to make a, you know, deal with the guilt of, I had to make the decision to have my, you know, animal put to sleep.
Yeah.
But it does put a lot of pressure on them, you know, so having the strengths to be able to have those discussions. They're dealing with life and death all the time, literally, and having the ability, I think, to be able to put an animal to sleep and how they cope with that. So some of the vets, you know, that I researched would look at it as, you know, this is a gift I can give to the animal. I can end this animal's suffering, you know. So other vets will say it's a form of treatment.
Yep.
You know, and that's just the way it is. You know, they all have their own different ways to cope with it. Yeah, I mean, I have vets on a pedestal. I just think they're awesome people, because, I mean, you look at what they do, you know, they're doctors and dentists and pathologists and radiographers and surgeons and, you know, all of these different things that they have to learn, all wrapped up into one. You know, and you think if we had to go and see each of those specialists in the human world, you know, that, you know, five or six different appointments just, you know, for all of that. And then the vet is basically doing it all, you know, they're the phlebotomist, they're taking the bloods and, you know, making that analysis. And so they're so highly skilled as well. But, you know, I would also say probably the passion, you know, I think is definitely a strength. And I would see that in the majority of vets. I know, you know, that not 100% of the vets are doing it all for the same reason. I'm yet to meet one that hasn't got the passion for the animals. You know, everyone that I've met or worked with, you know, it's just the passion, and so determined, you know, to do what they're doing and having the best outcome for the pets. Yeah. And sadly it's putting them at risk as well.
Yeah, so they're bringing wonderful attributes and capabilities and strengths, as we were just talking about, into this profession. And then perhaps there's just some additional skill development, because a lot of the things we're talking about around that assertiveness and how to have those difficult conversations, and even the skill of how to deal with people who are perhaps treating us in a way that isn't necessarily fair. You know, the skill of actually maintaining our thought processes around that so that we don't let it affect us to the detriment of our mental health and well-being. So these are some of the things that you do cover in the book.
Definitely.
Can you really just give us a little rundown? So the kind of the latter half of the book, I suppose, or maybe the latter third, the numbers, is actually a program on, you know, coping and it's a coping and wellbeing program for veterinary professionals. So it's in a very practical, with kind of exercises and activities and things that people can do.
Yeah.
Walk us through that really quickly. Give us a flavor.
Yeah, absolutely. So I put that together when I was looking at what I believed made up well-being, like psychological well-being, you know, and again, aside from the exercise and nutrition, which I'm not qualified to talk about. So I was looking at what are the vets dealing with, and, you know, the stress management, you know, we're highly stressed, the time management, because, you know, they don't know necessarily from day to day what's going to walk in their door, what emergency is going to come through, you know, so it's quite normal not to have their lunch breaks and to be working 10 or 12 hour days. So we wanted to look at practical strategies that could try and help that in some way. Obviously, you know, we can't predict what's going to come through the door, but it's trying to have some really clear exercises. So we'll cluster some of these activities together rather than stopping and taking every phone call, cluster them and do them all in one go, you know, just things like that.
Yep.
So we looked at stress management, time management, communication skills, you know, and built the assertiveness in with that, which, you know, is the best way to communicate with people, and doing it assertively, not aggressively or passive aggressively or passively. We looked at goal setting, you know, okay, so where do we want to be? What do we want our careers to be? Where do we want to go with that? Not everyone wants to stay in the vet profession. It's like, and if that's what their decision is, that's okay. You know,
I can imagine that there'd be people who, you know, there's all sorts of areas of specialty as well.
Definitely.
Isn't there?
Yeah.
you know, project and say, look, I'm not loving the client focused stuff. Maybe there's something that less of that.
Absolutely. Getting away from that clinical focus and whether they're going into pharmaceuticals or research or, you know, all those different areas. So there's a lot of places that they can go to take that. And I think it's thinking outside the square as to, well, what else do I really want to do and where do I want to go with this? But then we brought in the positive psychology and the acceptance and commitment therapy, which are, two of the evidence-based interventions that are out there. They're personally my therapy of choice. Acceptance and commitment therapy, in a nutshell, is about, you know, accepting what you can't change or control, but committing to take action, so committing to act or behave in a manner that's consistent with your values, which are those things that give you your sense of meaning and purpose, the things you want to stand for. Yeah. And so it helps us, you know, I think we were just saying before, when we've got all of these thoughts going through our head or we've got all of these unhelpful emotions or feelings running through our body, how do we deal with that? You know, when we're faced with this client who's yelling at us and in our face and we just want to yell back, but we know professionally that that's not going to be the best outcome, how do we deal with that? Or how do we deal with it when someone's walked out the door and hurled abuse at us as they've walked out the door? You know, how do we not take that on board and buy into it? So, again, it's an evidence-based strategy. I find it's very common sense kind of approach once you know how to use it.
I think that's why it's so popular amongst psychologists generally.
I think it is. Yeah, I really think it is. I mean, and I've had clients that, you know, when we've looked at other approaches, I say, but if I knew what other thoughts to be having, I'd be having them.
Yeah.
So whereas this is sort of like, well, let's just accept those thoughts for what they are, but then it's about our behaviour that's going to have the consequences. And then, of course, the positive psychology, I like to use that from a well-being perspective as a supplement to ACT, or if I'm working with a client or a group that they might be feeling great, because not every vet out there or vet nurse is stressed. You know, there are a lot of them that are really loving and enjoying their job and do have that well-being. So how do we maintain that level of well-being?
Yeah.
You know, and again, that positive psychology, it's, you know, predominantly looking at the character strengths plus the whole host of other exercises that you can bring into it as well. So I facilitated that through my doctoral research with two separate groups. We did pre and post testing of using the program and the strategies, and it was effective or statistically significant in reducing stress, anxiety and depression and negative effect, which is from the positive psychology aspect. So, you know, which is a fancy way of saying it worked, you know, and it's a start. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to go out there and say, look, it's the only program that'll have any success, but it's a good start and we know it works. We've got the evidence behind it because we're using evidence-based strategies. So we expected it was going to work and, you know, fortunately it did. So, but I think being equipped with those coping strategies for anybody really is what we need to be able to deal with the demands of everyday life, whether it's work, whether it's home, whether it's both. You know, we need to be able to cope with those effectively so that we're not looking at suicide, you know, or self-medication and other unhealthy things as our only option.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was just thinking, you know, as you mentioned all of that that's contained within the program, they're life skills for everyone, aren't they?
Absolutely.
You can take the vet piece out of this.
Absolutely.
And the same program would be so useful for everybody to get a better handle on interpersonal management and conflict, on their communication, on their time management, on their stress management, on those components that make up the acceptance and commitment therapy.
Absolutely. Know,
and the program change and taking action.
Exactly. I actually trialed it before I used it in my doctoral research. We'd run a pilot program. So we had some funding from Medicare locals up here on the Gold Coast, and we actually ran it as a wellbeing program using animal-assisted therapy. So we had my labby was trained as a therapy dog, and I had a girlfriend who had a service dog. So we actually trialed the program through that, and it was really effective. And that was just to general population. It wasn't to vets at all. And then it was like, maybe we're onto something, because I wanted to look at some. There's so much research around, you know, the high burnout, the high suicide rate, but there's very little there that addresses what to do about it. And that's where I thought, you know, as a psychologist, I'm in a position, you know, to be able to address that and try and come up with something. Whereas, you know, a lot of there's limitations from other people that have done research because they haven't got those qualifications, or again, not in a position to be able to you know, talk about psychological things. So
yeah,
a nice balance. But yeah, certainly the strategies are for anybody, really. So, but they worked with the vet. So that was our big like woohoo.
Yeah. And so that's all contained within the book, yes. But you also have online programs that cover some of these topics as well. Is that right?
Definitely. So each of those modules has been separated into like a standalone module as well as an online course, or the majority are available as an ebook as well. Some people prefer to download and read. Yeah. The whole package is on there, again, as an online program, or the program or just components of it, depending what clients want, is available as a face-to-face workshop as well. So, I've done quite a few workshops, especially between Melbourne and the Gold Coast as well, with big groups as well as private clients, really looking at predominantly the positive psychology and resiliency from a wellbeing perspective, but also the acceptance and commitment therapy to get the coping strategies just built in, and get those happening. The whole program, it's probably like a day or a day and a half ideally to run through everything. Mm-hmm. But for me, I think that the two evidence-based strategies, the positive psych and the ACT, are the biggest things to get into.
To really, make a start and just give people those skills. I know that's what I find in delivering these sorts of programs within the workplaces that I work in, is that it's just giving people some really quite basic skills in many ways, but very, very practical and tangible skills that help them to, really thrive and flourish in every area of their life. And that's what the beauty of the PosPsych approach, I suppose, is that it doesn't matter where you're at. You might be struggling with some aspects of your wellbeing. Yep. And you'll benefit from it. You might be in pretty good shape and you'll still benefit from
exactly,
it.
Exactly. And I think they're life skills that we can all use, like just because, and I often say this to clients, because I think there's a perception as psychologists, we don't have any stress and our lives are perfect. It's like, no, we still have. Yeah, exactly. It's like,
as if.
It'd be like, yeah, we wish. It's like we still have these issues too, but, I guess we're in a position that we know how to be able to deal with them. We know the strategies and the signs and the symptoms to be able to work with them, but also that's why I love the positive psychology, because it keeps the well-being aspect happening, that I sort of, touch wood, think everything's going along really well for me. So I like to maintain that, I'm very optimistic naturally. So it's like, how do I maintain that, and how do I, when things are going a little bit stressful, how do I use those strengths that I have and those kind of strategies to really start to put things into perspective? And again, that's where I like just knowing that you've got this toolbox of resources that you can draw on whatever you need right at that time. And I think a lot of it too, if you have those effective coping strategies, some of the other symptoms, the stress might start to reduce because the thoughts aren't contributing to the stress, and those sorts of things. So, I think a lot of them go hand in hand very nicely.
Very much so. Simple things that we can do to really improve the different facets of our lives, whether we're a vet or not.
Yep. Or a psychologist or exactly.
Yeah, any of the professions. So the book I mentioned before is called Coping with Stress and Burnout as a Veterinarian. That's not the easiest word.
I know. So we abbreviate it to vet. And I've had some people saying, we don't like it abbreviated. And then I've asked a lot of colleagues, vet, it's easy. It's fine. So you're trying to be respectful, but it's like it's easier.
I understand. And that's published by Australian Academic Press.
Yes.
And it's available via the Australian Academic Press website.
Yes.
It's also on Amazon, I noticed today. So I'll pop links to where people can get hold of the book in our show notes for this episode. I'm also going to pop a link to your website so that people can find you and learn more about the work that you do, your research, and also the programs that you run. So you mentioned the ebook, the modules for online courses, and also how to contact you for face-to-face workshops.
Which
you deliver
around
the country.
Yep. So, and some of those are sponsored and free. We did one in Melbourne last year that was sponsored by Veterinary Growth Partners as well. So it was free to veterinary professionals to attend. Yep. And then we're running one actually next week that's sponsored by PetSure Pet Insurance and supported by AVA New South Wales Division. That's in Sydney, and that's, again, free for veterinary professionals. So hopefully we'll have some more of these pop-up workshops.
Yeah, perfect.
Try and get as many people trained, I guess, and get the strategies out there as we can.
Yeah, that's what we need, isn't it, is having that sponsorship access so that the cost
definitely
the vets themselves or practice owners, and therefore the organisations like the insurers and other professional bodies are making their contribution to the profession and the mental health and wellbeing.
Definitely, which I think, you know, that's sort of, there is a much greater awareness now, you know, especially with the Love Your Pet, Love Your Vet, that's, you know, there's a lot of support that's gone global, you know, and obviously, you know, it's now a registered charity. So we want to be able to give back to the vet industry through that as well, through educational or psychological support as well, you know, and hooking up with professionals, you know, registered psychologists through the country. So if, you know, we've got a vet or a nurse or a tech, you know, someone, you know, in Victoria that needs to go and talk to somebody and get the strategies, then we can facilitate that and sort of make it happen, basically.
Fantastic. So, yeah. Okay, and I'll pop details of the Love Your Pet, Love Your Vet campaign in our show notes.
Thank you. Well, a little bit greedy, you know, you can never have too many websites. And
Nadine, thank you so much for your time today. It's been really interesting talking to you. I don't think I probably really appreciated that there are psychologists just specializing in particular
in one area.
I think it's wonderful the contribution that you are making to, well, not only the psychological profession, but also the veterinary profession and really helping to hone in on some obvious issues and provide the support and the learning and the skills that people need to really thrive and flourish. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Not a problem at all.
That was psychologist, author and expert in wellbeing in the veterinary profession, Dr. Nadine Hamilton. And if you're a vet or a family member of a vet or a vet student or even just a human being who gets stressed at times, I really would encourage you to get a hold of a copy of Nadine's book or explore her courses or workshops. Because as we discussed, the tips that she covers, the stress management, the time management and the other skills that she covers in the book and her programs are all evidence-based, so we know that they work and they really do apply to each and every one of us. Hers is specific to those in the veterinary profession, but really it does apply. All the tips and tools and techniques that she talks about apply to everybody. The links, as well as the link to Love Your Pet, Love Your Vet, the education campaign, can all be found in the show notes for this episode, and that's at potential.com.au/podcast. And I think it's time to tell you about what's coming up next week, because it's one of my favourite topics. It's sleep. March the 15th is International Sleep Day, and to prepare and to help you to prepare for better sleep, I'm talking to Dr. Kate Sprecher from the University of Colorado, Boulder. And Kate is an expert in the science of sleep, and she'll be sharing some of the reasons why good sleep is vital to our health and well-being, and maybe more importantly, more helpfully, although it's all helpful and such an interesting conversation, her tips for getting better sleep, because I know that's something that we will all struggle with at some time. So here's a little sneak peek of what Kate has to say.
It seems that if you get less than 7 hours of sleep, most people show negative impacts on health, cognition, mood. There are very, very rare people who need less than that. There are many people who get less than that, and many of us need more than that.
That's next week on the Potential Psychology Podcast. It's going to be a great conversation. I will see you then, but in the meantime, go forth and fulfill your potential.